Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 134. I'm recording it on Monday, May 4th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Matt's Blues. The title of the podcast is Risk Without Risk. I believe I spoke briefly about the title Risk Without Risk comes from a thread starter that I put to the Motley Fool board. My recollection is it was Easter Monday of 2003. So you can go back and find that one. I imagine it's still there. And I love the title, Risk Without Risk. I'll tell you what it means in a second. I love the title. It's just a funny title. It's a paradoxical title, and those are the kinds I like. And I love titles that present a challenge. I love titles that you think there's no way he's painted himself into a corner. There's no way he's going to back that up. And then if you actually do it, I think it's cool. And I think I can show how investing is largely about taking on risk that is not really risk. That's how you invest successfully. Taking on risk, because risk translates into higher returns. And that's what you want. So take on risk, but do it without really taking on risk. And it sounds like a puzzle. How can you do that? How can you take on risk and get the returns that follow from taking on risk, but at the same time, not really take on any risk? So you get all the benefits and none of the drawbacks. That sounds too good to be true. My wife said that about, I was telling her about the investment strategy tester, a calculator that John Russell and I recently developed, now at the websites. And I told her, I said, you know, I wrote the default results and I give a description of the calculator, and the default results tell people how they can make back all the money they lost in the stock crash over the course of the next 30 years, just by switching from the conventional indexing approach to the valuation-informed indexing approach. And she, you know, we're just driving in the car, and she says, well, you know, my reaction to that would be, that just sounds too good to be true. And it kills me, because I agree with her. I agree with her. I think that's what a lot of people are going to, they're going to come to the site, they're going to see that, and they're going to say, oh, this is too good to be true. He's another hypester, you know. But the truth is, it's too good to be true, and that it's so wonderful. The idea that, you know, you've invested passively, you've made this horrible mistake, you've lost most of your retirement money, you're feeling bad, you're feeling down, you were already worried about your retirement, you were already way behind, and this guy's telling you can get all that money back? Holy moly, that can't be true. But if you go by the historical data, the calculator's all based on historical data, how stocks have always performed in the past, it says it is true. But people can't believe it. It's just too good. And of course, what's really going on is that there's nothing magical about valuation-informed indexing. There's nothing magical about rational investing. It's all simple common sense. There's no scheme, none of that. The scheme is passive investing. The problem is we have come to believe in get-rich-quick schemes as prudent. Passive investing is the biggest get-rich-quick scheme in the history of the world, probably. Certainly in the history of the United States. And, you know, we have experts touting it as if it's prudent, as if it's safe, as if it's reasonable, as if it's sensible. And so then when you hear what really works, what makes sense, it sounds like that must be a scheme. So the reason you can make up all this money, if I were saying you can make it all back in a week, then it would be a scheme. That really would be too good to be true. But what I'm saying is over 30 years. And of course, you know, when you think about it, is it really so strange to think that if you invest rationally for 30 years, you'll do better than if you invest emotionally, which is what passive investing is, a purely emotional approach. So it's really not too good to be true, but it strikes us as too good to be true when we are still recovering from the passive investing era, and we are still in the early months of recovering from the passive investing era. Anyway, what risk without risk means, what the phrase means, and I say I used it in that old post back in 2003, and I wanted to use it in the book I'm writing. I wanted to have a chapter called Risk Without Risk. I don't think I'm going to have a chapter. I think it's too obscure a phrase to justify a chapter, but I'll have a section that I'll call Risk Without Risk. Sections within the chapters, so it won't get as high profile because it's a little too obscure, I think, for a whole chapter. But what risk without risk means is, the best example is where we were in January of 2000. January of 2000 was the height of the bubble, the height of the stock bubble. And if you invested in Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, TIPS, you got a government guaranteed return of 4% real per year for 10 years. Great return. If you invested in stocks, the historical data shows, and you can check this out at the calculator, the stock return predictor, the most likely 10-year return on your money was a negative 1%. So you get a negative return with stocks, and you get a pretty darn strong positive return from a risk-free asset class, a government guarantee return. So you're getting... The question is, how do you get such a... why is the differential? Why do you get paid so much higher a return for going with the absolutely safe asset class? That seems paradoxical. It seems backwards. The reason is the safe asset class at the top of the bubble was perceived as risky. People were saying, oh, you'll fall behind in your retirement if you put your money in anything safe. You've got to go with the riskiest asset class of all at the riskiest time in history. You've got to, or you'll fall behind. Stocks for the long run, buy and hold, stay the course, pixie dust. And so people were going with stocks. They perceived cash as being the riskiest asset class of all and stocks as being the safest. So the perceived risk of cash was very, very, very high. But the real risk was non-existent, because it has a government guarantee. So you were taking on the kind of risk that gets you return, which is perceived risk, not actual risk. That's the great flaw in the passive investing model. The huge mistake that has caused our economic crisis is the idea that the way you get returns on your money in investing is to take on risk, and that's not true. You can take on huge risks. Stocks were hugely risky. Back before the price crash. The risk was just off the charts, but it wasn't perceived because the experts were telling us that stocks for the long run, all these marketing slogans. So what you want to do is to take on perceived risk, because that will yield you a great long-term return, but you don't want to take on real risk because that could make you lose money. So take on lots of perceived risk and take on almost no real risk, and you're gold. You're gold. And that's what you try to do as a rational investor. What you try to do is you look at the realities. You don't look at the marketing slogans being generated by the stock selling industry. You look at the realities. Things like the historical data. How have stocks always performed in the past? When you know how stocks have always performed in the past, you know when the long-term return on stocks makes them worth owning, which is most of the time, and you know when you want to run, not walk, away from stocks because the risk is just sky high. That was the situation from 1995 through the first part of 2008. You don't want to have too much of your money tied up in an asset class where a huge price crash is inevitable. So in this podcast, I love this concept of risk without risk. It's basically what it's saying is we need to, you know, go back to the drawing board, throw away just about everything you talk about in investing really comes down to risk. That's all it, all investing analysis is an examination of risk. And during the passive investing era, our understanding of risk is totally backwards, totally the opposite of what it is in the real world. And all of the convoluted arguments you hear from investment analysts today all come from this fact. that they're spending all of their efforts studying risk, and their understanding of risk is just 100% the opposite of how it really works. So everything is upside down. So they're telling you to invest in stocks when you should be getting out of stocks, and they're telling you to get out of stocks when you should be investing in stocks. Everything is backwards. And what we need to do is just clear the decks, forget everything we've been told for 30 years, the passive investing era, throw that stuff in the garbage can, and start fresh. And then we're on our way, because we've got the intelligence, we've got wonderful people who have examined these issues going back 30 years now. We have academic research showing how stock investing works in the real world. But we need to re-examine every question, and that includes, most of these questions are really questions of risk. So the purpose of this podcast is to just give an overview of some of the questions we will be re-examining as we shift from the failed passive investing model to the, you know, what we hope will be the model of the future, the rational investing model, the model where we say not that you should never change your stock allocation, but that you must change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. That's the rational model. Now, I'm using the term risk without risk because I just think it's catchy, but I'm going to use it in sort of a broad definition. I'm not going to look only at this question of perceived risk versus actual risk. That's how I first came up with the phrase risk without risk. But what we're really dealing with is in a bigger picture sense is all risk questions need to be reexamined. So things that we thought were risky are really not risky, and things that we thought were not risky really are risky. So we're redefining what risk means. And what I did was my boy had a Little League game Saturday, and I took him to the game, and I usually keep score. They usually ask me to keep score because they don't want to ask me to coach because I'm too pathetic. But so I while I was keeping score in between innings when they would take a, you know, when they would switch sides, I would just scribble down some thoughts. And that's what this is. So this is not any great, you know, well-formulated presentation. But I think the thoughts are interesting. It's just, you know, different thoughts. And over time, we need to, you know, flesh these out. Probably each of these would be just would justify a future podcast sometime in the future. And we'll just flesh them out over time and get to understand what risk is all about in investing. And basically, the key, the hard part here is not what I'll go through. What I'll go through, I think, will be fairly easy. The hard part is letting go of the passive investing ideas that are, you know, messing up your thinking. If you're thinking that risk is what they say it is in the passive investing era, then it makes it very confusing. This is something that always bothers me. A lot of the experts say, well, we can't tell middle-class investors what we've learned over the past 30 years because they're so emotional, the poor dears. They're so emotional, they won't understand. You know, my experience with middle-class investors is they understand a lot more than most of the experts give them credit for. The problem is, it's very hard to make sense out of investing if you believe that valuations have no effect on long-term returns. It's like trying to make sense of, you know, living on planet Earth if you don't believe in gravity. You know, it's the most basic rule, and you've got to understand it before you can do anything else. And so we need to get the basics right. But once we throw the passive investing stuff out, it becomes possible to get the basics right. And I think people are perfectly, you know, most people are perfectly capable of understanding. And so please don't get intimidated by the other thing I wanted to say is please don't get intimidated by, you know, I'll be mentioning all these different types of risk that you either haven't heard about before or haven't explored in any depth. This doesn't mean you need to devote, you know, years of your life to understanding these things. You're not going to get any of these risk evaluations precisely right. You don't need to. What you need to do, what passive investing is all about, passive investing is a fear-based model. It's about little boys. I think of all the people who came up with passive investing as little boys who are afraid of the big bad world, and they're adolescents and they're growing up and they're going to have to go out and make their way in the world, and they're scared. And what they do with passive investing is they say, oh, but, you know, like, well, you know, they sometimes we dress, you know, boys and girls dress up. You know, they put on daddy's shoes and they pretend they're going off to work. They put on a jacket or something. And they're just acting. They're acting. And that's where we are in our investment advice as of today. It's all a big act. And the purpose is to keep the fear away. the fear that we can't handle ourselves. And you see that more when people become teenagers, you know, and they have to make their way in the world. What am I going to be? What am I going to do? What's my life going to be about? And they go out, you know, driving 90 miles an hour, you know, drunk. And it's crazy behavior. No one would do such a thing who was rational. But they're dealing with all these emotional issues. They're thinking, oh, you know, I don't know what I'm going to be. Am I going to be in the Army? I'm thinking of signing up for the Army next week. Or am I going to go to college? I don't know if I'm really college material. If I go to college, am I going to study engineering? Am I going to study accounting? Am I going to study journalism? What am I going to do? I think I'm sort of good at acting, but you can't make money as an actor. Am I going to study drama? What? I'd like to play baseball. I enjoy that, but what's my odds? And you've got all these things. Who am I going to marry? You know, I'm dating this person, but you know, my best friend thinks she's not the one for me, and all this stuff running through your head. And so you go out and do something really stupid to block it all out because you can't deal with the emotional anxiety. That's what passive investing. What they do is, investing is a little bit scary. That it is. You know, I don't deny there's no fear there. It's a little bit scary. You're putting your money at risk. And what the passive investors do, these little boys, they say, hey, if I could reduce everything that investing is about down to just some little equation that I can understand and nothing else matters, oh, you know, then I wouldn't be afraid anymore. Then I'd be brave and strong, and I'd be willing to put all my retirement money into stocks then. And so they just play this game, and they say, it's a mind game. And they say, oh, risk, it's all just volatility, that's all. And, oh, if you'll just stay in the market, oh, it'll be fine. And it'll, you'll be fine. You'll get the market. You'll get a good return. It'll work out. It'll be good. You won't get hurt. No, you won't get hurt, Johnny. It just doesn't work out that way. It's baloney, and it's fearful thinking. The reality is, yeah, there are a lot of different risks. Volatility is not the only risk. It's not even that big a deal, really, if you understand what you're doing. But there are a lot of risks. But you don't have to get them all right. See, the one thing that they love about passive investing is they reduce it all to a calculation. And they can get the calculation precisely right. And they say, oh, I know everything. I know the calculation. I know everything there is to know. I'm not afraid. I'm a mastermind. I've got it all figured out. You don't have to get it all right. What you have to do is you have to deal with the real issues. That's what you need the courage to do. That's the secret of successful long-term investing. Deal with reality, not this phony, baloney, make-believe world of the passive investors. Deal with reality. But don't be intimidated. Don't get scared. People tend to fall in one extreme or the other. Either they become passive investors, which is to become 100% emotional in their investing ideas, or they get so intimidated they just say, I can't put my money in stocks. I gotta go with money markets, or I gotta go with bonds, or whatever it is. What you have to do is work up the courage to face the realities of stock investing. And when you do that, you will gain courage over time, but you will never get it all right. You will always make mistakes. Always. And that's okay. What you want to do is get it roughly right. And you can, any person of reasonable intelligence can get it roughly right, who doesn't emotionally cripple himself by becoming a passive investor. All right, that's enough preface. Let's hit some of the items. One item, here's a huge risk item, and I have not heard anyone discuss it other than Rob Bennett. If there's someone else out there, please let me know. Huge risk item. I get asked all the time, it's probably the most popular question today, you know, what should I do with my money? People are saying, I've lost a lot of money. Everybody knows it's a big problem. But people are saying prices are better, and you seem to be one of those, Rob. You're saying prices are better, aren't you? And the answer is yes. Prices are now at fair value. Well, what should I do with my money? Should I put it in stocks? Should I stay out of stocks? What should I do, Rob? And the answer I give to that is, I say at the beginning of every podcast, at today's prices, we are now at fair value. We were at insane price levels before the crash. We're now at fair value. Stocks today offer a strong long-term value proposition. Now, you have to parse that sentence or you can get in trouble. does that mean? You know, what does that mean? They want to know, what allocation is that, Rob? 10%, 50%, 90%, what? Tell us, guru, tell us. Listening to gurus will get you killed. There is no one answer. What I do when I'm asked that question is I always divide the answer up. I say, are you a rational investor? Someone who was going with a low stock allocation before the crash, maybe 20%, something like that. Or are you a passive investor? Somebody who was listening to the experts and maybe was going with 50% or 60% or 70% or heaven help us all 80% before the stock crash. If you are a passive investor, which means an emotional investor, or at least you have been up until the stock crash, the risk of going with 50% stocks today for you is sky high. But if you're a rational investor, I think 50% stocks today probably makes a good bit of sense. So what I'm saying is there is no one answer. It depends. Why is there such a difference? Because a rational investor was going with, say, 20% before the crash. Now prices are far, far, far better. He hasn't lost money. He's lost a little bit. He hasn't lost much. He's not shaken up, the rational investor, and he's been waiting for years for this opportunity to buy stocks at good prices. Stocks haven't been available at the prices that apply today, I don't think any time from the 1990s forward. You have to go back to the 80s to find a time when we were at a P10 level of 15. Long, long time ago, I don't know how many years. Obviously, in 82, we were down around 8 or 9, we were lower then, but from the late 80s forward, we've been at higher than 15. So you'd have to go a long ways back to find prices as good as those that apply today. So for the rational investor, I don't think you should necessarily put all your money in stocks today, because in all likelihood, we're going to see another 50% price crash. Probably not this year, but who knows when? Could be another year, 2 years, 3 years, could be 4 years. I don't know. Short-term timing doesn't work. I can't tell you. But the rational investor doesn't care about that too much. Cares a little. That, you know, you don't want to. In other words, if you're going to get a good return in 10 years, what real difference does it make if you have a 50% crash? So the rational investor doesn't get too upset about that. So he's going to put maybe 50% in stocks today. But the passive investor, he's already taken a huge hit. He's already licking his wounds. He's already found out that all his investing ideas don't hold water. He's already experienced 9 years of poor performance. If we have a jump in prices as a result of all this government spending, which I imagine we will, I don't know for sure, he's going to get his hopes up. He's going to get his little emotional hopes up. And then when we experience another 50% crash, he's going to get his emotions dashed again. He's going to be wiped out. It's going to be the last crash of the passive investing era. For a passive investor to be at 50% stocks today, I think is dangerous. He's too emotionally fragile to handle this. I think this is why Robert Shiller, you know, says he has a zero stock. When he was asked, what should you have your stock allocation? He said, I'm at zero until prices go lower. I think he's afraid that if he tells people to start putting money in stocks now, they're going to get wiped out in the 50% crash. But you don't have to. If you're rational, if you understand how stock investing works, which means understanding the historical data and its message, I think a 50% stock allocation can make a lot of sense. But if you have a long history of passive investing, you're just not in a position to be putting your money in stocks, you know, in today's environment. The aftermath of the hugest bull market in history. This is not something you want to do. So my point here is, in a nutshell, there's a risk. The risk of investing in stocks today is not the same for all investors. It depends. Do you follow the passive investing mindset, the emotional approach, or do you follow the rational investing mindset, which is based on how stocks have always performed in the past? If you believe in the rational mindset, you should be going with a very different allocation than if you believe in the passive mindset. So you can't, the way the passives think about it is the risk is in the asset class. You know, they say our stock's risky. The question is, let's look at stocks and figure out what they are. But that's not where most of the risk is. Most of the risk is in the being who purchases the stocks, the human. Every stock transaction has humans involved. Humans. And humans are emotional. The risk is in the human emotion. The stock class is fairly easy to analyze. It's not too hard to figure out the risk in stocks. You just go to the historical data, you build a calculator, you know, like I have at my website. I have four of them. That can be done. That's, you know, it takes a little work. It's not a big deal. But studying the risk of the human part of the equation, that's a lifetime's work. That's what I spend most of my time on. So the risk is not the same for the passives and the rationals, and you cannot talk intelligently about stock investing unless you understand that and unless you make that demarcation in all of your analysis. It's just too important to leave out. You know, bonds is one that came up. I'll hit this one briefly, but people sometimes talk about, they say, what's the alternative to stocks? And I have a whole podcast on that. And people still today, they still put forward bonds as the alternative to stocks. And I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. If you are well-trained and you understand bonds can be a great alternative to stocks, but most people are not. There's little discussion of bonds in the general media. And so talk about risk. Risk is investing in an asset class you don't understand. Let me say it again. Risk is investing in an asset class you don't understand. Most middle-class investors, millions of us today, are investing in asset classes we don't understand. We think we understand stocks, and we don't, but we think we do. So that one is bad. It's dangerous as all get out, but it's at least understandable. We think we understand. Bonds, we don't even pretend to understand, most of us. We've never even read a book about bonds. Most of us have read a book about stocks somewhere down the line. How many have read a book about bonds? If you don't understand it, you shouldn't be invested in it. Rob Bennett's opinion, you know, it's not the conventional view. If you don't agree, please. There are other people on the internet telling other stories. Please. But I would not put my money in bonds if I don't understand them. And I can't, you know, I'm fully capable of understanding them. I have the intellectual ability to understand bonds, but I have other things I want to do with my life. And so I don't intend to study them. And until I have the time, until time opens up in my schedule to study bonds, I'm not going to put money in them. Why? Because if I put money in something I don't understand, when we go through a period of volatility like we're going through today, and this is common, this is the way investing works, there's periods of apparent peace followed by times of volatility. That's just the way it is. Always has been. Never has it been any different. When I go into a time of volatility, I'm going to bail. I know that about myself. I've got enough sense to know that. I've got enough self-reflection to know that. So the thing to do is limit myself to things I understand. People used to say to me all the time, they'd say, Rob, you're this big believer in valuations. Well, they say the Japanese market is way down, Rob. Why don't you put all your money in Japan? Japan stocks. You know, because they hate it that I was in TIPS paying 3.5 real. That just drives them bonkers. You can't ever get 3.5 real. That's a sin. I think I'm doing a lot better than the people who put all their money in stocks, but they can't accept that. So they say, why don't you put it in Japan stocks? That would make them happy. You know, if I did that, they say, oh, you're my friend again. You know, at least you're in stocks. You're not in U.S. stocks like me, but at least you're in stocks. I can talk to you again. I don't understand. And my answer always, this question was posed to me many times. It's a good question. It's an intelligent question. But what I say is, look, it may be that there's a great deal in Japan stocks. I have read people say that. I've read people I respect say that. That's a good deal. Good long-term deal. But Japan stocks, I don't know anything about the Japanese market. You know, in other words, the U.S. market, I read in magazines, books, it's in the newspapers all the time. I don't know everything about it, but I know something about it. I know almost nothing about Japan and their market and, you know, what's going on. And if I put my money in Japan, in a year, if the Japanese market collapsed, it would cause me great fear. And the fear would be not just the collapse, it would be it's collapsing and I don't know why. Whereas when it collapsed in the U.S., I know darn well why. I was on discussion boards talking about it for years before it happened. So I know darn well why it collapsed. I understand it. So it doesn't really scare me. But if I were in Japan, it would. And so you can't know everything, and I don't know everything about the U.S. market. You've got to take some calculated risk. But I feel if I invest in U.S. stocks or in TIPS, I have an idea what I'm doing, enough that I can, you know, the best I can do. I have to invest somewhere. I don't, you know, there is no neutral. You got to do something. But I'm not going to put my money in Japan because, you know, they might be playing games with the accounting over there and it looks like it's fairly valued and it's really not. I just do not know. I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying I do not know. And I'm saying if I am going to invest in Japan, I need to study Japan. And as of today, I don't have time. If time opens up, it might be the investing deal of a lifetime. But not today, not this boy, because I don't have time. And I recommend you follow the same practice. That's risk. Again, the risk is not the asset class. The risk is the human owning the asset class. That's the risk. That's the real risk. The risk that matters in the real world. So if you understand Japan, sure, go with it. If you understand bonds, go with it if it looks good. But if you don't, if you're not willing to put the time in, I would recommend you not go into it. And so my original point about bonds was people continue to cite bonds as the second, you know, as the main alternative to stocks. Stocks and then bonds. Most of us don't understand bonds, and bonds are far more dangerous than bonds became the second asset class at a time when inflation was very low. And now, ever since the 70s, the risk of inflation going very high has always been with us. And bonds are just not as attractive a deal as they once were, in my opinion. So I think you're taking on the risk. What I'm saying is the risk has changed. Risk is not a constant. And once you see this happen, you know, you don't just say, well, now inflation's down for a couple of years, I'll put all my money in bonds. The risk is there. The risk that inflation's going to break out and bondholders are going to get killed. I'm talking about bonds that are not adjusted for inflation. TIPS are. That's why I'm willing to put my money in TIPS, because it's got an inflation adjustment. But that's a risk, and it seems to get ignored. It's not a perceived risk. Bonds are still perceived as the primary alternative to stocks, even though inflation has changed the rules of the game. People just, there's like inertia is the greatest force in human life. Once there was a book written that said bonds are the alternative to stocks, people just are not willing to give it up, and they don't care that inflation changed the rules of the game. They just don't let that in. I think you have to let that in. So that's another case where real risk, and I would say the real risk of bonds is much greater than the perceived risk. Non-inflation adjusted bonds. So I question whether the return on bonds is what it should be. Now, there are, of course, times, and there are particular bonds you can buy that I'm sure the likely return is very appealing. But again, that takes a little bit of study to find out what those are. And if you're just the typical middle-class investor, you probably don't have the time or the skill needed to identify which bonds are worth investing in at which times. And if you don't, you've got to find something more simple, which I think is stocks when they offer a good long-term value proposition, or an inflation-adjusted bonds when stocks don't offer a good long-term value proposition. The risk of the depression, that's a risk we all should be talking about. I'd like to do a whole podcast on that, but it keeps getting pushed off. But if we, you know, should I calculate that in? When I say to people, stocks offer a good long-term value proposition. Well, if we have a depression, not a recession, but a depression, you know, there have been people saying we may see a world, if we have a depression, it's probably not going to be just the United States. It's going to be global. We have a global economy for the most part. If we have a global depression, should you be invested heavily in stocks, even though they're selling at good prices? Well, if you know we're going to have a global depression, I'd say no. If we're going to have a global depression, all bets are off, really. The historical data doesn't matter. You know, historical data is great as long as that country, you know, remains in existence. But at some point, all countries come to an end. And historical data doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, the currency gets marked down to just about zero, and the stock market collapses, and you start over, or the country's gone, and you have a new country with a new name. Or frankly, in the global depression we're talking about here, Wall Street Journal put it at 20%. They had an article that put it at 20%. And I think it's at least 20%. I think it might be 30%. Somewhere in that neighborhood. I tend to think 30, but yeah, it's just a guess. But 20 to 30% odds. If there's a depression, it's probably going to be a global depression. If there's a global depression, there's probably going to be a world war. I mean, that would follow. And if there's a world war at a time of chemical weapons and nuclear weapons, there's a good chance it's game over. You know, we don't like to talk about it, but isn't that so? So, is that a risk? Well, it is in some sort of objective sense. It's a risk. In other words, you could put your money in stocks at very good prices. You know, even if the P/10 level drops to 8, where the long-term value proposition is, something like 15% real, every year for 10 years, you know, this extraordinary value proposition, you could put all your money in stocks at those prices, and we have a global war, and the world gets blown up, and you get no return at all. Should I be counting that as risk? I don't count it. And the reason I don't count it is, it's a risk in an objective sense, but in a real world practical sense, I don't see what difference it makes. What you're trying to do when you decide where to put your money is to compare and contrast. You're comparing relative risk. You know, is my money going to do better in I-bonds, or is it going to do better in stocks, or is it going to do better in Japanese stocks, or whatever it happens to be? If we have a global war and we're all blown up, the money doesn't mean anything. So there is no relative risk. So it all seems sort of comical. I mean, comical is maybe not the right word, but it seems absurd. Maybe is the right word. Pointless. So if we're talking about the risk of the world blowing up, I just feel none of these questions matter. You know, why waste your time listening to investing podcasts if the world's going to blow up within the next 5 years? You should be doing something else with your time. Praying, pray, repent now, friends. The end is near. So that to me is not a real risk. In some technical sense, it is. But in terms of how I analyze risk, I don't even count it because it's just there's nothing you can do with the information. Some people might say go to gold. Because maybe the whole world won't blow up. Maybe the currency will be destroyed in the world. Well, that's fine. If that's what you think, go with gold. But my feeling is, if we're going to have a global depression, I don't know. Maybe I'm too defeatist. I just feel like if that's going to happen, I'm not sure I care. I'm not even sure I care enough to go to gold. So, I have nothing against having a little bit of gold. But my feeling is, if things are going to get that bad, I'm more or less cooked. And money issues are not my concern. So, For purposes of my analysis, I don't really let it influence my thinking very much. I don't think it's a phony concern. I think there is a possibility, but I don't let it influence my thinking because I don't see what I can do with it. It doesn't help me examine relative risk to know that there's a 20 or 30% chance of a global depression. Is it risky to go global? That's a different question. Some people say once upon a time people were saying, if you're invested in the S&P 500, you're covered because of the U.S. companies, the multinationals, they invest globally. That's good enough. You have exposure to the global market. Then whenever the S&P 500 does poorly, they say, oh, no. You need to be global. You see, if you would invest globally in a passive way, that would work. But the people who are saying that passive doesn't work, oh, they're making a terrible mistake. They're invested in the S&P. That's what we used to say you should buy and hold. Last year, we used to say put all your money in S&P and it'll work forever if you never move it. But this year, we're saying you got to put it somewhere else and it'll work if you never move it. You see? You can't listen to what we said last year that you should do forever. That won't work. This year, the thing you're supposed to do forever and ever and ever is something very different. And next month, it'll be something altogether different again. You see, the way passive investing works is we change what you have to do forever and ever, every month or two. It's the buy and hold of the month club. passive investing. So if you will just keep up with the new developments, passive will always have good numbers. Oh, it will always work. But it can't work if we have to stick with what we're buying and holding. That can't work. I mean, come on, that's not fair. So should you be going global or staying with the S&P 500 or the you know, you could do the total stock index of the U.S.? I think there's arguments both ways. I think the argument, and I don't want to go through them all. That would be a separate podcast. But what I would say is the theme that I've been pursuing here is it depends on how much you know. If you understand investing well enough to go global, it might make sense because it does seem that there's a trend where we're going to a global economy. So that makes a certain amount of sense that it's not really going to be the U.S. calling the tune. And if the U.S. isn't calling the tune, we may not be getting that 6.5 real in the U.S. in the future. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe the global economy is not as close as it sometimes seems. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Who knows? If you understand the U.S. stock market better, which most of us, I think that's true because we're exposed to discussion of the U.S. stock market all the time and rarely to discussions of the global markets unless you read Barron's, you know, unless you make it a little bit of a hobby to dig. If you know the U.S. market better, I tend to think you should go with the U.S. market. This is the sort of thing that I feel John Bogle's very good at. I feel that John Bogle, instead of giving perfect advice, has a practice of giving advice that practically works. He tries to simplify, and he tells people, look, U.S. is good enough. And it's not, you know, I don't think it's 100% right, but it's close enough, and for most people, I think it's pretty good advice. Where I think Bogle went off the tracks was he simplified on the question of valuations, and there the issue is so big that you just can't simplify without destroying people's lives. So I don't advocate simplifying there. I think you've got to take valuations into account. But I think the idea of staying with the S&P, I think is reasonable. It may not be the ideal, but you've got to consider how much you know. And if you're not willing to put the time in to understand global markets, there's a risk in going global. So there's risk both ways. And as I say, there's no neutral ground in investing. You've got to choose one or the other. You can't do both. At least you can't do both with all your money. You could split it up, and that might be a good answer for some. There is no one answer. There's no one-size-fits-all answers in investing. This is why I don't think you shouldn't be looking for gurus to tell you what to do. What you should be looking for gurus to do, so-called gurus, you should be looking for teachers, people who will teach you so that you will have the understanding yourself and that you can make your own decisions and then live with them. And sometimes the best teachers are somebody doing something like what, and I try to do it, what Bogle does, simplify things. I think that's sometimes the best, but you have to be careful not to oversimplify. If you oversimplify, you cause people more trouble. So you have to simplify the things that can be simplified and don't simplify the things that cannot be responsibly simplified, in Rob Bennett's opinion. Is it risky to be out of stocks? This is something, I mentioned this in an earlier podcast, it came up in the 90s. A lot of people were arguing that, you know, people always talk about stocks being risky. And some people were saying, hey, it's risky not to be in stocks. Really? Because inflation is eating up our money over time. And if you put it in a money market, you're not keeping up with inflation, maybe. But in stocks, you are. Because the companies have to keep up with inflation and they have to earn a profit on top of that. So they'd say, oh, it's risky to be out of stocks. Now, I am... You know me, if you've listened to the earlier podcast, I think that a lot of the advice put forward in the 90s was just flat out irresponsible, reckless, dangerous stuff. But what do I think of this argument, that it's sometimes risky to be out of stocks? I think there's some truth to it. I don't think we should throw that one overboard. I don't think there's any truth to the idea of you can invest passively, you don't need to change your allocation. I think that idea is bonkersville. But I think the idea that It can sometimes be more dangerous to be out of stocks. I think there's some truth in that. And it's a big issue today. See, the unfortunate thing is they were pumping it back in the 90s when everybody was overinvested in stocks. Today, they're not pumping it as hard, and today we might need to hear that message because a lot of people today are scared of stocks, and they're going to zero stock allocations, and they're losing time if they do that. You see, we don't know the short term. I'm telling you there's going to be a 50% crash. I don't know that for sure, first of all. Might not happen. And secondly, I have no idea when. And if it takes a long time, say it takes 10 years. During those 10 years, you might be earning a better return in stocks. So waiting until after the 50% crash, I think, is a mistake. In general, there is no one rule. You have to look at your individual circumstances. But as a general rule, I think everybody should have some stock allocation at all times, even if it's low. And the one exception, as I say, are the passives who are just so emotional that they need to take a break. They need to take a year out and sort of, you know, collect their wits. But in general, I think it's a mistake to take extreme positions. And I think there is a risk in being out of stocks, that the sand keeps going through the hourglass for all those years you're out of stocks. And maybe if you stay in stocks, it gives you motivation to learn more because you want to protect your money. And you need to learn more. One of your jobs as a middle-class worker today, whether you like it or not, is to learn something about investing. You don't have to spend years of effort, but you probably do have to spend a weekend or two sitting down with a book and figuring out the basics, or a website. So I think there is a risk of being out of stocks. I think that's a real risk. And I think that should be included when we talk about risk. It's one of the risks of investing. It's in a funny way, it's a risk of stocks. Now, some people could say, well, how can it be a risk of stocks that there's a risk of being out of stocks? That seems like the opposite. Well, what happens is, what we have to do, you know, during the 90s, people would bring this up all the time. They would mock people. There were always people who were not willing to be in stocks in the 90s. All the experts were pushing stocks, you know, like crazy. Just this, you know, unrelenting promotion pitch. And there were people who would not give in. They were outliers. There weren't many of them, but there were some of them. And they'd say, oh, they'd mock these people. Oh, they're so pathetic. They just won't get in stocks because they lost. And what they don't get is the people who won't get in stocks, they're wrong, I think. I think they made a bad decision, but they're not stupid. There's a reason why they feel so strong. The reason why they feel so strong is being invested in stocks at a time when passive investing becomes popular is such a devastating life experience that for many of us, we'll never recover from it. If we live through it once, we will never, ever be able to be invested in stocks again. So when these people who were doing the promoting of passive investing caused millions, you know, they thought they were advocating stocks. What they really were doing is causing people to suffer bone-crushing losses, which in turn will cause them to stay out of stocks for decades and to lose money during those decades. So the risk of being out of stocks, I think, is a serious risk. But it is a product of being in stocks excessively that causes it. In other words, over-investing in stocks causes an emotional reaction to get out of stocks. So over-investing in stocks, which is passive investing, basically, ignoring price leads down the road to being out of stocks for long periods of time. And that's a big risk of stock investing. So you never want to do that. You never want to go too high with your allocation. And the key to not going too high is looking at the historical data, seeing how dangerous it is to go too high. When you know the numbers, when you know how bad it is for people who overinvest in stocks at times of high prices, you won't be inclined to do it. You'll say, I want to keep my retirement money. I don't want to lose it all. So you'll see the numbers. So a great risk. The risk is not in the asset class. You can't blame stocks for the fact that we overinvest in them. The stocks aren't doing it to us. It's the mind games we're playing, trying to trick ourselves into thinking the price doesn't matter only when it comes to stocks. We all know that price matters in every other thing we buy, but for some reason reason should be in quotes. We come to believe that price doesn't matter with stocks. Right. Price doesn't matter with stocks. That makes sense. Yeah, good point. Good point. All the pieces of the puzzle are finally beginning to click into place. The risk of loss compounding. This is a risk that is... I'm going to do a podcast just on young investors, because young investors have been just... Oh, everybody, of course, has been hurt during the passive investing era. And a lot of people think the biggest hurt was done to retirees or close to retirees. And then you can make an argument, and I've done work on retirees. First thing I did when I started looking at investing 7 years ago was to try to correct the errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, and those studies are used for retirees. So I am, I have concerns. Millions of people are going to suffer busted retirements in all likelihood because of the errors in those studies that have been left uncorrected to this day. So retirees have been hurt big time. Investing ineffectively when you're close to retirement or in retirement, really, really hurts. But I don't think it necessarily follows that the worst damage has been done to retirees. You could argue it, and I don't say for sure it's the other way, but I think a good argument could be made that in some cases, it's young people who are suffering the worst hit. Why do I say that? The theory of passive investing seems to be, it doesn't matter what young people do. Let them take on insane risks. So what? If they lose all their money, they can just recover. Well, it's not that simple. If you lose all your money at 30 years of age, you're losing not just the money that you lost in the stock crash. You're losing years of compounding on that money. And when we're engaged in saving, they point this out all the time. They say, if you're a 30-year-old, you should be saving because you'll get all this compounding and your benefit. Well, why doesn't that work with stock investing? If 30-year-olds are investing passively, engaging in reckless investing behavior, and they lose all their money as a result, don't they also lose the compounding returns on that money? Sure seems so to me. So the risk isn't, it's not these ordinary things we, it's not volatility. It's losing compounding. And of course the answer that the passives will give, or the passive advocates will give, is they'll say, they're going to get that money back in 30 years. And it's true. If you look at the historical data, even if you suffer a wipeout, as so many of us have, the odds are you'll get your money back in 30 years if you keep it in stocks. But what happens to all the compounding that you lost for 30 years? Where if you had invested rationally, if you had followed your common sense and lowered your stock allocation when prices went to insane levels, you'd have 30 years of compounding to benefit from. What happens to that? They leave that out. It doesn't fit the passive investing marketing campaign to tell people about compounding, that compounding affects not only savers, it affects investors. Savers and investors are the same people, for heaven's sake. Of course it infects both. So a big risk in investing is to forget that the compounding returns phenomenon applies to investors. And if the compounding returns phenomenon applies, you sure don't want to be investing passively. You want to be taking price into account when you set your stock allocation, if you understand the effect of compounding. When you look at the calculator, look at the scenario surfer, and you'll see this. It takes you through a 30-year return sequence where you can choose your allocation each year. And what happens, valuation-informed indexing almost always beats rebalancing. It's rare for it not to win over 30 years. But if you go back and examine, after the 30-year time period is done, after you run a test, go back and say, why does valuation-informed indexing always win? The answer is, it appears to me, that the answer, it's almost always a compounding phenomenon. There's usually only a couple time periods, one or two, in the 30-year sequence in which valuation-informed indexing makes a difference. And the other years, valuation-informed indexing and passive indexing lead to pretty much the same allocation. Those one or two times, though, sometimes it happens in the first year, sometimes it happens in the 10th year, sometimes it happens in the 15th year. You don't know when. But whenever it happens, from that day forward, the valuation-informed indexer gets more compounding from that point forward. And that adds up. And at the end of 30 years, he's usually way on top, sometimes double the returns. But it's not, you know, the human mind has a hard time taking in how powerful compounding is. This is one of the problems. This is why people can look at passive and say, oh, it doesn't sound that bad, you know, because their minds, it's just like, it's the same thing our minds do when we say, oh, if I don't save any money, it can't hurt me that much. It just doesn't seem like it would hurt you that much. But when you take compounding into effect, it hurts a lot. You don't want to lose, you know, the sorts of money that we've been losing in the stock crashes that follow from a time when passive becomes popular. It adds up. It adds up. The amount that we've lost, the nominal losses we've suffered are a tiny bit of what the long-term losses are going to be. The long-term loss is going to be much greater. So compounding is a real phenomenon, not just for savers, but for investors as well. The risk of a late start retirement plan. They don't ever bring this up. But this one, I think it's very serious. And if you've played poker, you'll understand this one. You know, they talk about investing risk as if all the risk is in the asset class. All the risk is in the volatility. No, the risk is in the investor. Now, what if the investor got a late start on his retirement plan? So he's behind. What's he going to do? I'll tell you what, I think it was Money Magazine, I'm not sure, I remember seeing an article on this. It said, what to do if you got a late start? It said, go with a higher stock allocation. This was when prices were insane, when your odds of getting a good return were almost nil. Go with a higher stock allocation. Now, anybody who's ever played poker knows what that's all about. The guy who's losing, the guy who falls behind, gets desperate to catch up, and he starts making bigger and bigger bets. You know, double or nothing bets, triple or nothing bets, with the thought, you know, I'm so far behind, I want to end up ahead by the end of the night. I got to bet big. And of course, what happens is that rarely works. He gets more and more emotional, and he falls off a cliff. He ends up with nothing. All the other players take his money. That's what happens to the guy who's got a late start retirement plan. He says, I've got to go with a higher, I've got to take on more risk. This is how they rationalize it. Stocks pay a higher return, don't they? Because they're more risky. Well, if you're behind in your retirement plan, you've got to take on even more risk. 80% stocks, that's not enough. You got to go 90, you got to take on more risk. You end up with nothing. You end up losing it all. So what I'm saying here is, if you fall behind in your retirement planning, you are increasing the risk of investing. People don't think about it that way. They try to compartmentalize. They say, oh, putting together a retirement plan, that's a money management question or a saving question. That's not an investing question. No, the two categories bleed into one another. It's an investing question. It's an investing question. The risk of extreme allocations. A lot of people will ask me, you know, they'll use these calculators and they say, Rob, from 95 through 2008, stocks had a horrible long-term return. They were at least expected to have. Why should I have any stocks? Why not zero? And I'd say, well, fine. The trouble is, extreme allocations, as a rule, do not work because short-term prices are unpredictable. So if you go with an extreme allocation, and I think zero is an extreme allocation, you're probably going to get hurt. Because what can happen is, look at what happened in 95. 95, stocks were insanely overvalued. The logical thing to do was to go to zero, going by the numbers, strictly the numbers, ignoring emotions. And look what happened. 5 years of great returns, 96, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 5 years. If you are at a zero stock allocation, you're going to feel emotional pain if all your friends and neighbors are getting great returns for 5 years and you're not. And that's going to tempt you to go back into stocks at just the worst time for doing so. You'll go back in, you know, in January of 2000 and then lose it all in the years that follow. Better to go with 30% and you protect yourself from a price. This is my opinion. Just my opinion. Better to go to 30%. You protect yourself from the effect of a huge price crash that you know is coming eventually, but you don't know when. But you also stay in the game. So you get a little bit of the action if prices go up and you're not emotionally distraught. The point is, think through emotionally you know, there's more than one scenario. Just because prices are insanely high doesn't mean they're going to collapse the next month. So think it through. Say, well, if they do collapse next month, I don't want to be at 70% stock, so I'm going down to 30. But what if they stay? Or what if they go up over the next 5 years? Then, I don't want to be at zero. Same thing today. This is what I try to tell people. You know, you can look at the numbers and say, well, you should be at a high stock allocation today. And going strictly by the numbers, that's true. But what if we see a move up and then 3 years from now, a bone-crushing stock crash? How are you going to feel then? So maybe you want to moderate that stock allocation. Maybe instead of going with 80% stocks like the numbers would justify, maybe you want to go with 50, maybe 40. Depends on your personal circumstances. But you've got to consider these emotional factors. And you don't have to get it precisely right. You know, you don't have to say, oh, it should be 48.3% stocks. No. You know, if it should be 48 and you go with 50, you'll be fine. If it should be 48 and you go with 45, you'll be fine. Don't sweat the details. Get the big picture right. But the big picture means not only looking at the numbers. You do have to look at the numbers for guidance, I believe. I think you're making a mistake not to look at the numbers. But don't look only at the numbers. Because the numbers don't include the emotions that you'll feel living through watching the numbers play out. So you've got to have a, you know, you got to look at the calculators, learn the numbers, and then in your head, think through what's going to be like to live through the various scenarios that are possible. And that's why we have a scenario surfer calculator. So you can play out scenarios, play out as many of them as you want, hundreds if you want. You can go to the strategy tester and play out thousands and see what happens in all sorts of different possibilities. And what you want is the allocation that works, that has the best odds of working in the highest percentage of those possible scenarios. That's what you're trying to do. And again, I don't want to make it sound intimidating. I don't want to make it sound like it's so complicated you can't handle it. You don't have to get it exactly right. It's not, it doesn't take that much work to get it. You know, it's an 80-20 rule. 20% of the work will get it close. And that's what distinguishes successful investors from unsuccessful investors. Passive investors spend 80% of their efforts on the 20% that doesn't matter. But smart, rational investors spend their energies on the part that does matter, on the 80% that matters. But it only takes 20% of the work. The part that matters just doesn't take all that much effort, but you have to do it. You can't skip it. The passive skip the stuff that matters, and they spend all their time on trivialities. They get into endless bickering, quarrels about trivialities that really don't amount to much. Spend your time on what matters. Your stock allocation matters. That's the thing you have control over. That's how you lower your risk, by getting your allocation right. And the sort of factors I'm listing in this podcast, I think, are the factors you should be taking into consideration without sweating them to death. Just thinking them over and saying, yeah, well, I don't think I want to go with zero, but I sure don't want to go with 80, you know, maybe 40, maybe 50, something in there. Risk of success. Very few people think that being successful in investing carries risk. It sure does. There are a lot of people who invested, they thought they were investing successfully in the 90s. Now, all they were doing was investing luckily. You know, they were following a doomed strategy, passive investing, and that happened to be an era when passive investing was king of the hill. Rational investing did well, and passive investing did well from 75 through 95 for 20 years. For 5 years, 95 through 2000, rational did poorly, and passive was just stunning. And now ever since, rational has been superior. People who got those stunning returns in 95, a lot of them, the lesson they drew was, hey, prices don't matter. All my friends are saying, my common sense is telling me I should have lowered my allocation. But look, no. Prices don't matter. I can't listen to common sense. Ruling out consideration of common sense is the worst thing you can do. So get it. Being successful in the late 90s was risky. It gave people big heads. People suffer from big head disease. Millions. millions of investors, and experts, millions of experts, suffer from big head disease because of what happened in the late 90s. That was a risk of stock investing. Stock investing does that to people over and over and over again. It's nothing new. Nothing new. We should be taught, when we talk about the risk of stock investing, the risk of suffering big head disease, we've got to include that in the list. That's a risk of stock investing, that's going to happen to you. There's a risk of losses, I already mentioned, getting out of stocks. A lot of people that suffer big head disease end up suffering huge losses, which causes them to get out of stocks, and that's a risk of stock investing. There's no other asset class where you suffer such devastating losses that you're likely to abandon that asset class forever. But stocks are sure one that cause that over and over and over again. Nothing new, as I said. If you hear people from the 30s who got wiped out and got out of stocks forever, instead of laughing at them, try to think what made them feel that way. Try to understand that they're humans like you are and form a kinship. Say, what can I learn from them, from their experience? Yes, they were wrong to stay out of stocks forever. Absolutely. But why did they do it? Instead of laughing at them, try to understand them. And the answer is they went with an asset class that is dangerous, and they went with it at the most dangerous time in history, and the sorts of losses you can suffer when you do that are so great that humans can't emotionally recover in one lifetime. And you don't want that to happen to you. So pull back a little bit. Pull back a little bit. The risk of thinking big. This is what I think of my friends at the Retire Early community. A lot of people had big gains in the late 90s. Somebody pointed this out. I think it was Ben Solar. I'm not sure. Yeah, it was Ben Solar. He talked about how, you know, he did some kind of survey where he asked people, you know, when is it that you decided you had enough to retire early? And there were huge numbers in the late 90s that said, yeah, I have enough to retire early. Now, they were all living in illusion. They weren't adjusting their portfolios for valuations. So they were pretending, you know, oh, I've got $2 million. And, you know, really, if you adjusted it, it was one-third that, because stocks were valued at three times fair value. So instead of having $2 million, maybe they had $800,000. And they're handing in resignations from high-paying jobs thinking, hey, I got $2 million. I'm a big shot. Thinking too big is a huge risk of stock investing, because if you adjust for valuations, you don't have the problem. Then you always keep your numbers. You know roughly what you really have. But boy, there's nothing worse than handing in a resignation from a high-paying job and not be able to get it back after your portfolio reverts to the mean. John Bogle's the one who taught me about reversion to the mean. So I knew I didn't want to hand in my resignation based on huge stock returns, because I knew that, I wouldn't have the money to live on. I felt good, sure, you know, as long as the prices were insane. But how about when the prices return to normal levels? Then I can't go back to my employer and say, hey, would you please give me my job back? Stocks performed the way they always have in the past. I need my job back. They don't want to hear that story. So thinking big is a risk, and it's a risk of stock investing. It's not a risk of tip investing or even bond investing really that much. It's a risk of stock investing. Only stocks are as deceptive as stocks are. Stocks mislead us in powerful ways that no other investment class can mislead us. I have a section in the book where I refer to stocks as the devil's favorite asset class. Because, see, humans, we're all failed creatures. We're all flawed creatures. And we're drawn to pride. Pride is a temptation. And when we're all struggling to have enough to retire. And when you look at numbers on your portfolio statement that tell you you have enough, it's as human as human can be to think, yeah, I did that. I accomplished the goal. I saved enough to retire. I invested effectively. You buy into it all. This is why I think we should adjust the numbers for valuations. We should give people accurate numbers in their portfolio statements. There's no harm in giving the nominal number, but we should also give a valuation adjusted number so that people have a better idea what their real worth is. Not the temporary inflated value, because people make decisions based on those numbers, and they get themselves in great trouble as a result. It's impossible to manage your financial affairs properly unless you have some idea of your true net worth. And if you're using unadjusted stock numbers, you're not doing that. Gain illusion. I'll go through this one quick, but I think of John Graney, and I don't want to go through all the history, but John Graney is the guy that he has a retire early study at his website, retireearlyhomepage.com. And I don't know John's exact numbers. I know rough numbers. He started out, I think, he retired with roughly $500,000, a very small amount of money. But John is not married. He does not have kids. He lives in an apartment. He doesn't have a mortgage. So, and he's frugal. So $500,000 was, you know, barely enough for him to get by. He happened to retire at a time of huge stock gains, and that $500,000, I don't know what it went up to, but I think it went up close to $3 million at the high point. So huge gains. And this is why he became so popular. People were saying, hey, I'd like to do that. I'd like to retire at 40. That'd be great. Well, now he's lost roughly $1.5 million. So let's say now he's down to $1.5 million. He went with a 90% stock allocation when prices were insane. So now he's somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 million, let's say. I don't know exactly. He's still, let's say we suffer another 50% crash, as I say we may, if we go by the historical record. That might bring him down to $800,000. He's still, and this is inflation adjusted. So he still had a big gain from $500,000. If you look at the numbers, it is not likely that John's going to suffer a busted retirement. Even though he overinvested in stocks, even though he used bad safe withdrawal rate numbers, he's probably not going to suffer a busted retirement. Why? Well, he was lucky to have been born at the right time. He happened to be born at a time where, when he acquired his assets, we were going through an upward swing in one of these crazy swings that Mr. Market goes through. And if you enjoy the upward swing, the downward swing hurts, but it doesn't hurt as much. Because you've got as time passes, you sort of build in a comfort zone. In other words, you've had enough gains, and you've had compounding on those gains that even the downward drops don't destroy you. Whereas if you got into stocks heavily for the first time in the year 2000, you've never had any gains. All you've seen is the downside of stock investing. So John, I think, will more or less end up okay, but he still suffered. He still suffered the risk of what I call gain illusion. He didn't think of it. If he had only understood that his gain was from 500 to 800, he'd be fine. But he thought of his gain as being 500 to 3 million. And because of that, he ended up losing 1.5 million or whatever the number is that he didn't have to lose. He could be a million richer today or a million point five richer. But he believed in a fantasy. He believed in a fantasy. That's gain illusion. Gain illusion is probably the biggest risk of stocks, really. You could, you know, there are dozens of varieties of gain illusion. That's what it's all about. They talk about the risk of stocks being volatility. It's not volatility itself that is the problem. Volatility can be handled. Just look at a calculator that tells you how the long-term return changes, and you know how to respond to volatility. It's not that big a deal. The killer is what the volatility does to your emotions. That's the killer. That's the killer. If you start thinking that money is real, look out below. Look out below. And that's what John did. As I say, John, he benefited from being born at the right time. So the benefit he got under that form of risk countered the damage he did to himself with gain illusion. Some of us, though, suffer from both. Some of us suffer from gain illusion, and then they suffer the risk of being born at the wrong time rather than the right time. So there's all kinds of risks associated with stock investing that are rarely talked about in the literature, rarely talked about by the experts. You need to learn about these risks. And all of them can be countered just by taking price into consideration. And of course, you take price into consideration with every other asset you buy. You wouldn't think of buying a swimming pool or a vacation or a car or a house or a banana or a comic book without looking at price. You shouldn't do it with stocks either. And if you take price into consideration, your way of thinking about stocks will change. You will develop what I call X-ray vision, and everything you hear about stocks will be filtered through a rational investing perspective rather than a passive investing perspective. You'll become more and more confident in your investing decisions as time goes on rather than less and less confident, which is what happens to passives. So don't think that because I list so many different types of risks that stocks are too risky to invest in. That's not so. That's not so, in my opinion. And don't think that this is all so intimidating that you can't handle it. You can handle it, But you need to think about stocks realistically. And you can't do that unless you're willing to look at price. If you ignore price, you get trapped. You get caught up in this fantasy land thinking, and it just goes down, 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 down. Start thinking about price, and every day you'll understand stock investing better, and you'll be more confident in your decisions, and you won't ever get them all right, and you'll know that you don't need to. You'll come to understand that what matters is getting things roughly right, not perfectly right. Instead of avoiding the fear of loss, which is what passives do when they tell themselves these tall tales that price doesn't matter, you will be confronting the risk of stock investing. And by confronting it, learning how to overcome it. How many things are there in life that seem scary? It's like giving a speech. It seems scary as all get out the first time you do it. I used to be scared to give a speech. But by confronting it, by practicing, I overcame my fear, and now I love it. Every time I give a speech, I'm a little more confident. I know a little more what I'm doing. I know how to connect with an audience better. That's what you want to do with stock investing, you see? You want to confront the risk rather than run from it. And by confronting it, you will learn to conquer it. And so all the risks I'm listing, they're all variations on the theme of ignoring price. They're variations on the theme of investing emotionally rather than rationally. And you don't have to get them all right. You do have to take them all into consideration, at least at some level of consciousness. You have to try to get things roughly right. You can't live in ignorance. Denying price, denying that valuations affect long-term returns, is investing in ignorance. I mean no dig at all of my passive investing friends, but that is what I truly believe, and I have to say what I truly believe to do any good at all. If you have thoughts on risk, I'd love to hear them. Use the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page at the website to shoot me an email. Good luck with your investing strategies.